Welcome to the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. This is Episode 4, and I'm the co-founder and your host, Paul Rorschach-Tobin. With me tonight is co-founder Jesse Gitzman-Burke.
Hello.
And we've got a special guest tonight, Lester Crow and his Strolling Bones.
Hey, community.
Now, Lester, what is it that makes you so special?
I'm extremely tall.
You're a giant, from what I understand.
Yeah, I stand 7 feet tall, and I'm very, very narrow, skinny, so I call myself the Strolling Bones because I'm a huge Rolling Stones fan. But I'm a very big person, yes.
Do you have to shop at the Big and Tall store?
No, because if I shop at the Big and Tall store, they expect you to be big and tall,
and
I'm just tall. Yeah, I just have really big hands and feet. Other than that, I'm really skinny.
So that's a tip for everybody else out there. If you'd like to join us on the podcast, make sure you're at least 6 feet tall.
That's right. I barely made it at 6'1".
So I think we got a good show for you. Here we are back, episode 4. So we're running strong. We're keeping the streak alive every 2 weeks, bringing you some more knowledge about Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. This time around, we're going to start off with the news. Our system spotlight is going to be talking about careers and classes. Well, not classes, but careers, advancements, stance. And then the main topic we're continuing on with talking about our ruinous powers. This time we'll be going into Nurgle, the grandfather of decay. And of course, we've got your questions, but first off, we're going to start off with the news. And I think the biggest thing that's happened in the last 2 weeks is that Fantasy Flight has put out their official errata / FAQ up on the site. And I've gone through it a couple times. It's coming in. It's a compilation of, it's actually an update of the errata that they've had out previously. But this is the first one that contains the errata from the Guides and Vaults. And it's actually been a little bit controversial. I know on the Fantasy Flight official boards, things kind of blew up once the errata hit.
The whole front page is dominated by people flaming it and absolutely going nuts and complaining and petitioning for all sorts of stuff. So,
yeah, it's pretty wild. I think, I don't know. I personally feel that, you know, for the price of the products, they should do a little bit better job editing some of the stuff, especially in something that is supposed to clear up stuff. But at the same time, they did. They received so much ribbing for it. And I thought a lot of the stuff that I read on there was meant in good humor, or at least meant as as positive feedback to the creators. But yeah, it has been controversial, hey?
I think it's pretty obvious that, at least to me, that the Guides and Vaults were rushed. Maybe they could have used another round or another copy edit or something like that. But I mean, you think about the amount of data that they put into those books, the number of cards that they generated and all that stuff. And you think, you know, they've been working on it for maybe a year, maybe less, to put all that stuff together. So it's not surprising that they've got, you know, kind of those bugs built into the system, but at least they were good enough to come out and say, hey, here's the problems, you know, here's the things that didn't that got lost in the shuffle.
I think we're kind of just they've shown the quality level that they can consistently produce. I mean, they're putting out content on a semi-regular basis. Every product that's been released to date has had the exact same level of quality. I mean, it's not like even though the Guides and Vaults were supposed to sum it all up and bring it all back together, they did do that, but with the same amount of errors, their percentage of errors that you'd expect in any of the prior products. I hate to say it, but it's just becoming kind of what I come to expect, where you're going to get almost everything you need, and there might be a few typos and grammatical errors, or maybe a handful of inconsistencies, but you know, I haven't found any of them to be so disturbing that it actually breaks our game sessions. I know some people were complaining in particular about a couple action cards that directly conflicted with each other. One saying you add misfortune dice, the other one you add fortune dice. And, you know, that kind of thing, it gets a little confusing, but at the same time, you know, you figure out what it is, or the GM just makes a call on the fly and you can keep going with it.
It's not game breaking. Okay. Is what it is.
Yeah, not at all. It's and like they were really prompt with delivering the errata and the FAQ, which shows that they are paying attention and they do know that there is slight.
It shows that they proofread it afterwards.
And it's really tricky, though. I mean, like you said, Jesse, the format, like using so many cards, it's going to be pretty much impossible to make sure every single card matches every single write-up of a card in a book, you know? And that's one of my concerns about doing that in that fashion, making a Guides and Vaults edition of the game, I guess, because then everything's not together. And that's kind of one of my concerns about, well, that was one of my previous concerns. But then I got my hands on the Creatures Vault, and I mean, I think it's fantastic. So I don't really have any complaints personally.
You know, I don't. I've reviewed the errata and the FAQ, and you know, there's some good content in there. But frankly, if I could have done without it and been perfectly fine with the products that I purchased, they, like I said, the non-breaking element of what's in there, I can play the game exactly as I feel like and exactly as I intend to play it. Nothing's stopping me from having fun with it. So I think people are really just getting hung up on the fact that what they were delivered wasn't a perfect product.
Mm-hmm. I could agree with that.
Okay, so next up we've got, I know we've talked about it for quite a few episodes now, but Liber Fanatica, the online fan-based system, Liber Fanatica 8, or fanzine, I guess you call it, e-zine, online magazine, whatever, is continuing on. And Lester, you're actually one of the contributors on Liber Fanatica 8, which just got started.
Yeah, I'd call it a delicious morsel, eh? Sorry, I was delivering that for my Canadian fans. But anyway, yeah, it's going to be pretty good. We have a fellow out of England who's named Sean Connors, and he runs an excellent YouTube channel that talks about all things role-playing, basically. And he kind of got recruited by Jay, the lead developer of the last issue, number 7. And he's been kind of trying to keep everything together. We've chosen a theme, and the theme is going to be the criminal empire. I believe that was influenced by one of the cards out of the Game Master's toolkits, one of the Nemesis party sheets. But it's going to go into depth and detail about, you know, criminal activities in there. However, we've got several different contributors doing different things. There's talk of several different adventures being in this, but my plan is to make a travel article that is going to try to help narrators and players achieve a feeling of realism or at least adventure while they're moving from point A to point B. But mm-hmm. I kind of want to keep that a little under wraps. So
sure, but it's more than, you know, the wandering monster tables, right? So you have
there's no tables involved.
Yeah, so you know, the usual thing is you're traveling from one location to another, and you have exactly one random encounter that occurs between that location and the other location. Right, that's usual thing that people do.
Yeah, and that's not really what this is. This is more a write-up on the effects of what weather does. It's actually more, it's not really mechanical as of yet. We are going to add mechanics to it to help people who aren't necessarily good at putting mechanics to narrative. Elements, but
what I understand is, Lester, you're actually going to incorporate this to make it feel mechanically like it is part of the third edition rule set. So it's not just going to be roll a D100 and pick your results and you know, play out an encounter. You were thinking of kind of approaching it from a little more.
Yeah, it's going to be a little different than that. Now, there is going to be a way of randomly generating encounters or events on while you're on the road. We'll get into more detail.
Cool. Yeah, I don't want to spoil all of this.
Yeah, no.
But for the most part, it's just not narrative. It's going to tell you, okay, hot weather, this is what hot weather does, and give you ideas of how to add misfortune or fatigue or whatever while you are traveling. And we want to use Jesse's map.
Cool.
The super huge detailed map of the Warhammer Old World. We want to use that kind of in tandem with it. That's kind of the plan as of right now, but it's still kind of in the development processes.
And that's an excellent segue to our Pimp Jesse's part of the podcast. So you've got an update on your map. Right?
I do. We can create an acronym for this thing. It could be the Schmottwow.
Schmottwow?
Super huge detailed map of the world. Warhammer Old World. Anyway.
Sorry, that's too good.
I've been working on getting the kind of the final major update to the map completed. Just wrapped it up over the weekend, so I'm calling it the version 1.1 of the color version of the super huge detailed map of the Warhammer Old World. What this update included was a revamp to Sylvania, which a lot of people have been requesting. Also a revamp to Mootland. A considerable amount of just added detail, coloring, some texture adjustments. I added a lot of more art to all the individual buildings. They all have windows, doors, stone, a little bit better colorization and shading. So the level of detail overall was increased substantially. There was also a large update done to Troll Country, Kislev, and then I synced the Norska region with the new map coming out by some of the main contributors to that, which we'll link in the show notes once the new Norska map comes out. So it is available on Gitzman's Gallery. The Google Maps version of it is not up yet. That'll be up within the week, I think. But you can certainly download the PDF or the JPEG and go and print or do whatever you like. And there's an Easter egg somewhere on the map where I signed it. If anybody can find it, kudos.
I'm rubbing my hands with glee.
Good stuff.
So I am thrilled to be done with that map for a while. I'm going to set it down one of the other huge updates I did to the map was I made sure that all content to date for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd edition is represented on the map. So everything up to the Witch's Song, all that content is in place, all the appropriate rivers, new towns, the whole shebang. They're all in now. Hugeldahl, all of it.
That's sweet.
So we're going to wrap up the news talking about, if you've paid attention to the podcast, so we do our episodes once every other week. But in between, we've started peppering in some play sessions with them. And Jesse, you've been GMing a group through that.
I've been trying.
And Lester, you've actually joined us on the last session. Session 2 of We're Running Through Eye for an Eye right now, and we'll probably wrap that up this coming week. But I know, Jesse, you wanted to talk a little bit about how those play sessions are going.
Yeah, we've been having fun with it. I don't pretend to be an expert GM. I think I conceptually understand how to be a better GM than I actually am. We've been having fun with it, and this past week, instead of releasing one episode, we actually released episodes 1 and 2 of Eye for an Eye, so we'll do the third one probably this weekend. But we are looking, as we continue these live game session recordings, I think each adventure we do in the future, we're going to try and include a new group of players to invite new players to join us. So we are going to reach out to the community for anybody who would like to play remotely over Skype and Map Tools to play with us in our games and record them for the podcast. We'll have some details on that either on the Reckless Dice site or on the Fantasy Flight forums. But
in general, I mean, what we're looking for is the people who first have the books and the rules.
Right. This is not a substitution for purchasing the game in any way, shape, or form. Yeah. It's next to impossible to play if you don't own the components.
And that's just from a player's standpoint. So if you've got like player's guide, you're pretty much good to go, you know, unless you need something out of the adventurer's toolkit because you're playing an Ironbreaker or something like that. Right. So you don't need the GM side of things. We're going to kind of handle that kind of stuff, being the GMs ourselves. I think I might actually get in there for the next episode to be a GM.
Cool.
Give Jesse a quick break, but. And the other thing is that we are going to be recording it.
It'll keep the Israelis off me.
We need to be able to record. So we are looking for people who have decent internet connections and a good recording, a quiet place to record from, the ability to run Skype, all of those sorts of things as well. Because we can't quite do the post processing since we're pulling in bunches of different people every week for these play sessions. We can't do as much editing and post as we do for the regular episodes.
Yeah,
I have to say it's actually a great opportunity for anybody who doesn't get the chance to play as often, maybe due to their location or whatever. That's the way I'm affected by it. I have to be the narrator anytime I run a game, so it's a breath of fresh air to be able to play. It works really well. I think you run a good game.
to that effect, I would like to throw it out there that international players are more than welcome to play. We have done games where we've had people in about 6 different time zones all the way across the world into, you know, Eastern Europe. And, you know, we're out in California or Europe and Canada, Lester. But it really does lend itself really nicely for international play. So no problems there at all.
And we do try to do those sessions on the weekends so that the time zones are not quite as impactful, since we've all got day jobs and need to take care of those things as well. So
cool. So more details on that coming soon. We'll keep a roster going of people who are interested in playing and making sure everybody has an opportunity if they do want to participate.
Great. So that does it for the news. We're going to take a quick break, and then on the other side, we'll get into careers. I keep on saying classes. We get into the careers for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay and our system spot. And we're back. So we've got this system spotlight segment that we've got here, where we delve into more of the mechanical side of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. And we're kind of stepping through some of the basics of the system and tying them all together. So this time around, we're hitting another one of the classic differences of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay across all editions from other fantasy roleplaying games. And we're talking about careers tonight. Traditionally, you know, you look at the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is Dungeons & Dragons, and they have a certain set of classes, and the class kind of defines your profession, defines your character, defines your abilities and your skills and your talents and feats and all of those sorts of things. And with 4th edition, even, they've even reduced the number of classes down to these different types, right? They've got strikers and tanks and support guys and controllers and things like that, so... The difference is with Warhammer is, and again, this is across all of the editions, is that there is a large, large number of careers. We're over 40, into the 50s, I believe, with 3rd edition right now, and 2nd edition and 1st edition had tons of careers as well. So it's really a different way of defining your character. Than you've seen in a lot of other fantasy roleplay games.
Well, I think one of the big distinctions between a career versus a class is that it is just your career. It's not necessarily your character. It doesn't necessarily represent your ambitions. It may, but you know, you could be a disgruntled innkeeper, you know, and that sounds so boring to a D&D player coming into playing Warhammer, but you know, that could just be your starting point. That's where you were. And that's what you've been doing up until your adventure started, you know. So then your background has your communications with other NPC characters and your prior training and your abilities are kind of influenced by that style of life. It really adds to the role play abilities and not so much the statistical character advancement of leveling up a character. You're playing a character by having a career. You're not playing a fighter.
Yeah, I like right. that, you're not, for sure.
Yeah, you're not a class. And I think one of the things that you can potentially do as a disservice, if you've got some experienced or people who understand role-playing games that you're going through character creation with, is that they have the potential to point towards the pit fighter or the soldier or the bright wizard or things like that. You know, they're going to go for those careers that line up with a class that they understand. But if they actually, if you stretch yourself a little bit and you actually use the randomness of the careers, right? So if you look at the standard way when you first create a character of how you choose your career is you take all of the basic careers, put them in a big deck, right? Because this is Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition, so it's all based on cards. You put them in a deck, and then you draw 3 randomly. And if you meet the requirements for that, usually it's a racial requirement, right? High elves aren't necessarily going to be one thing the dwarves are going to be, vice versa. So if you meet those careers, and you've got 3 careers in front of you, those random careers in front of you, you choose one out of those 3. So you could wind up with rat catcher, innkeeper, and coachman, you know. So none of those point directly towards, well, I'm a big hero. I'm a big, you know, this is my identity and this is my role. But that's really one of the beautiful things about Warhammer is that, you know, it starts out with normal people.
Yeah, it's the willingness to take something that is not really exciting at the beginning and make it, turn it into something exciting. I mean, that's difficult for a lot of people to take in, to start out as something really, not just a level one warrior, but, you know, you are a level one peasant, you know, and there is something that's potentially unattractive in that concept to some other, compared to some other role-playing games. But at the same hand, there's something really exciting, like to me, about taking a character who is so ordinary and vulnerable and putting yourself out there in the world where you can be hurt. You know, you can try, and if you actually achieve something great, you really achieve something at that point, because you were nobody to begin with.
Yeah, and don't all good fantasy novels start out with at least one or two of the main characters totally being nobodies in the way of the power structure of the world? Yeah. You know, like, I don't know. I like the flavor of it a lot more, and it lends to role-playing better than the D&D classes system, I find.
And then you add in kind of this advancement system where instead of leveling up and becoming more powerful just by killing things and completing quests, you actually instead progress along a career path, which gets a little bit more and more sophisticated as you continue to grow within that career, or even abandon that career for altogether and move into something else.
Right, because mechanically the careers are kind of defined as what are the career skills that you do, so what are the skills that are open for you for advancement and for your initial character creation, and then also primary characteristics. And I know one of the things that a lot of people seem to miss when they're rolling up their characters or when they're creating their characters is that you get one free advance for your primary characteristics of your initial career. So if you pull a road warden as your initial career and you're a human road warden, you know, you start out with twos and everything. You actually get an extra one for toughness and one for intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's... Yeah, we covered that. That was one of the misconceptions that we had covered in our character creation feature. That was one. Yep. A lot of people missed that one. I know I did for a long time. I think you even pointed it out to me.
Yep.
Yeah, I missed it too.
And so your career mechanically is defined as those primary characteristics. There's going to be two characteristics there, and then there's going to be a handful of career skills that you're going to have, around half a dozen or so, and then a stance meter as well. So, you know, we've kind of touched on stance previously, and what that is the ability for your character to go into a reckless or a conservative frame of mind, and how that affects your dice roll. So some careers are reckless, some careers are conservative, and some careers are neutral. And that's very interesting because, you know, if you're playing the Troll Slayer, you're going to be more geared towards reckless. Usually the range type characters are more on the conservative side. The social based type characters are a lot of times, social based careers, sorry, are more on the conservative side as well. So that really allows you to drive kind of the theme of your character as well, not just your profession.
You know, I've loved the my favorite part about it, separate from the mechanical aspect of it, is that it gives that visual representation of your character's mood while you're just playing out the game. You know, I generally like to allow the players to be in at least where it be in one point of conservative or reckless while playing non-combat encounters, and it really allows them to you can tell just visually then what characters are acting aggressively or acting passively, and it allows me as a GM to understand how my NPCs are going to be reacting to them, because I may not always know, you know, what everybody's thinking, and this gives me a lot of visual cues to feed off of.
It's great role-playing aid for sure.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing to realize with that, I guess going back to the mechanics side of things, is that if you have more stance pieces on the conservative side or the reckless side, then that's your default stance for your actions, even when you're in neutral mode. So if you're a troll slayer, for example, and you've got a reckless temperament, you've got more reckless pieces on your stance meter than conservative pieces, even when you're in neutral mode, you're still using the red side. You're still using the red side of the card as opposed to the green side, because there is no neutral third side to all of the action cards.
So then how do you handle the neutral character or the neutral careers? Do you allow them to, at the beginning, as far as I understand, they have to choose if they want to be reckless or conservative?
That's right. So yeah, if you have a neutral career like the Road Warden, you choose, the player chooses at that point whether they want to go reckless or conservative. The other last thing mechanically that I want to cover is the talent sockets. So your abilities, that your kind of passive abilities, although some of the talents are active, those attach directly and are defined by your career. So there's actually little slots on the side that are color-coded that show whether it's a tactic or a reputation or a, what's the social one?
Isn't it called social?
Focus. Oh. No,
tactic. Reputation yeah. is the one for social, and focus would be the one for your mental, and tactics mental. Would be physical. Yeah.
Then there's the faith ones and the order ones for, and then there's tricks, is it? Was the one for,
the special one.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one for pets, yeah, is tricks.
Tricks for pets, and then, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I hope they develop that further, where the animal companion may play a larger role in later editions. Or late, not additions, but later supplements.
Yeah, definitely. The small but vicious dog was an interesting way of managing that as that kind of companion piece. And then, of course, you've got the amber wizards with their beast forms as well, which is kind of a little bit of a variation on that too, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I wonder if maybe when they start exploring wood elves a little bit more and getting a little more into the wood folk of the Empire, would they maybe start talking about, you know, other kinds of more exotic pets, maybe other like warhounds or wolves and things like that. Mm-hmm. Even birds like warhawks. It seemed like that might be an appropriate tie-in, because I mean, they don't have a wood elf book or content block scheduled yet, but, you know, typically if they follow their existing pattern, it has, you know, a focus, and then it has an Empire focus as well.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of pair it up. So maybe that could be the Empire focus.
Because as of right now, the only way that a career can have the animal companion is if you complete the rat catcher career all the way and then pay for the dedication bonus. And then you get the dog forever.
Mm.
Unless he dies.
But then you just get a new one, right? Head down to the pound and pick out a new puppy. Yeah,
exactly.
So I think the other thing that the career kind of drives for you is how you advance in the game. So at the end of every session, you get one experience point, which is very different from second edition and a lot of the other fantasy games out there, where you get hundreds of experience points. At a certain point, you go up a level. Very simple with Warhammer 3rd Edition. You get one experience point, usually two if you like complete an adventure or something like that, but one experience point at the end of the session, and then each experience point equals one advancement. And so for that, then you can spend that advancement, so every time you play, your character's got a new ability or a new power or has improved in some fashion. And that's handled on the back of the character sheet, which is through those career advances. And it's 10 advances is what you've got. Lester, I know you talked about the dedication bonus. That's what happens if you completely finish your career and go through all 10 advances. Out of those 10 advances, 4 of them are always defined. It doesn't matter what career you've got. You always have an extra action card, an extra talent, a new skill or specialty, and then increase your wound threshold, your hit points, by 1. But then the other 6 advancements are actually open, and those are defined by your career. So on the front of the career card, you see that there's a list of advancements that you can have, and a number next to it, so like maybe actions 2. That means you can spend up to 2 of those 6 open career advances to get new action cards. And again, those are happening every session. So things move forward pretty quickly. And I know that that has been some of the feedback and chatter that I've seen on the boards, is that potentially that people advance a little bit too quickly.
Well, I think especially it really depends. With the lack. It depends on how much experience the GM is divvying out at each session. I mean, I tend to be comfortable with 1 to 2 points per session. And then I've typically done like 3 when you actually do the finale session. And maybe that's a little bit faster than the rules suggest, but that, I don't know. I mean, that if you're doing if you do the Eye for an Eye campaign, for example, if you follow that route, you'd be just a little over halfway, or roughly halfway, through a career by the time you finished a full 3-session large campaign, or adventure rather. And then you do 1 or 2 small adventures after that. That's a lot of gaming to still be within 1 career. A lot of people are used to seeing a little more advancement, or change within their character, while they're playing. So that's probably the one reason I pursued that route. A lot of different routes you could take it, though.
Yeah, I find the lack of advanced careers is actually one reason why when I'm playing with my home group here, I don't divvy out experience as fast. Like, I have a set amount for the adventure, and if they played really well, I might award them with one at the end of the session. But usually I just wait for it till the end of the adventure, and then they get a lump sum, and then they can justify how their character gets these new abilities, let's say. But there aren't too many advanced careers, so if you advance the characters too quickly, then it starts to, like, anybody who's taken, say, initiate is going to be able to move on, but there isn't really an advanced career for the rat catcher. You know, they don't have small cat catcher yet, or whatever.
But I think that actually brings one of the things about this, is that the careers are not necessarily linear. I mean, there are specific careers that you talked about, like on the priest line or the wizard line, and even things like witch hunters. You go from zealot to witch hunter captain. Mm-hmm. But really, for the most part, it's not an upward path. There isn't a linear path. So going from a basic career to an advanced career is not necessarily what you need to do. Now, the advanced careers are cool because usually you get an extra talent is one of the things that you do with that. But beyond that, you're still looking at the same deck of action cards. You're still looking at the same series of talents that you've got out there. You know, you're still increasing your wound threshold and learning skills and all those sorts of things. So moving from one basic career to another basic career isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Especially if you want to get that little small but vicious dog. You know, you could be a witch hunter captain and then go become a rat catcher for a while so you can get a dog.
It's true.
So one of the things that I missed earlier when I was breaking down the careers is that every career has a special ability. For example, the rat catcher, its special ability is you get a small but vicious dog. So the important thing is that you can change careers at any point in the game. You need to spend advancements to change careers. So every career has 4 traits associated to it. So, for example, an agent career has basic, bureaucrat, social, and urban. So if I wanted to change from an agent to an agitator, which has the traits basic, rogue, social, and urban, that means that I need to spend 2 advancements. I need to spend 1 advancement for the change, and I need to spend a 2nd advancement because there's 1 trait difference between the two careers. So at any time, if I'm currently an agent, all I need to do is just stop my current advancement in that career, spend 2 advances, and then switch over to agitator. But if you stick through it, if you stay through all 10, the four defined, and then the 6 general advancements, then you can spend an 11th advancement, which is that dedication advancement, and you get to keep the special ability of that particular career. So as we mentioned before, as Lester, you mentioned before, if you do that, if you'd go through all 10 with the rat catcher, spend the 11th for the dedication bonus, then when you move on to the next career, you can take your small but vicious dog with you.
And that's what I plan on doing.
So you can bounce around if you want to, or you can really kind of stick with things and then start gathering up those special abilities from each of those careers and kind of mixing and matching with those.
And I think that's how you actually become kind of like a character powerhouse, is when you're able to actually kind of accumulate these multiple career core abilities that start stacking on top of each other.
Yeah, true.
You know, otherwise, you're just, you know, you're increasing your wound threshold, you're increasing your stance meter, but beyond that, your character, and maybe your statistics here and there, but your character really grows in several different ways when they're stacking up.
One of the other interesting things that I want to talk about in terms of advancement is that when you advance your characteristics, so your strength, toughness, intelligence, agility, willpower, and fellowship, when you advance those, when you advance them within the career, if you're advancing a primary characteristic of your career, you can use up to those 6 open career advancements to increase your characteristics. So you always need one more advancement the number of advancements that you're going to. So if you're increasing your strength from 3 to 4, you need to spend 4 advancements to increase your strength from 3 to 4. Since there's only 6 open career advancements that are available in any one career, the maximum that you can increase one of your characteristics is up to 6.
Oh, you can't just actually spend 7 and the extra ones will get wasted as far as advancing your career?
That's actually, the rules as written says 6 is the max.
Okay, I did not
know. That's what I've read, yeah. That's what I've read into it, is that you can only go 6. Unless, of course,
you can't become a bloodthirster. Damn.
Not unless you make a pact with chaos. Once you do that, then you're good to go.
You become an NPC at that point.
And that can always be house ruled too, right? And you also have the ability to add fortune dice to each of your characteristics.
Right. So that is an advancement as well, is that you can add fortune dice to your characteristics. So whenever you roll strength, you may have a strength of 3 plus 1 or 2 fortune dice. Those are always added to your dice pool whenever you roll any test, a skill test or a characteristic test based on that characteristic. Mm-hmm. So those are, you know, there's really a wide variety of advancements. Every career has kind of similar advancements, but the specifics of what skills you can take and how many of those open advancements you can take in that career really kind of mechanically defines the career. And then from a world standpoint, you know, on the back of each of those cards, or half a page basically in the player's guide, they give you a really nice rundown of how that career fits into the Warhammer world and kind of what you are and what you do. And I think that's quite nice. I mean, they even include some typical trappings with it, which are not things that you automatically get during your character creation. You have to buy that with your wealth and things like that. But it's the idea on how to play that role when you take that career. So I think that kind of covers careers in general. Anything else, guys? Anything that I missed?
No, I'm excited to talk about chaos. I think we're all drooling over Nurgle here, so let's...
He's my favorite.
All right, so let's just get to that. We'll take a quick break, and then on the other side, we'll talk all about Nurgle. And we're back. So here's our main topic for episode 4. We're continuing on with our talk about the ruinous powers. Last time around, we talked about Tzeentch, and this one is all about Nurgle. And I know I've got two Nurgle aficionados here with me tonight, so I think I'm going to let Jesse kind of kick things off and talk a little bit more about the Chaos Gods and where they come from, and then we'll dig into Nurgle.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of, before we get into Nurgle, talk a little more on a general Chaos level, and then maybe go back into Nurgle. But one of the things I was, as we began to talk about the different Chaos Powers last time and Undivided, it got me thinking on, well, you know, where do these guys come from? How do they function, or why do they function? And essentially, the Warhammer world is a lot about man versus himself, or, you know, the physical versus the mental. And the warp, or the realm of chaos, is kind of the spiritual world in a sense. And there are these warp entities, or kind of the spirits, if you will, of you know, slain warriors, and all these people have different personalities and traits, some good, some bad, and these kind of like spirits of like kind tend to attract one another. And as they attract to one another, they start creating these warp storms or maelstroms. And those, once they get powerful enough, begin forming a consciousness of themselves. And what we recognize as the four main chaos gods are these four huge maelstroms that represent some of the most common human characteristics. And these are their kind of the manifestations of them that then turn, you know, a lot of these are evil, but I mean, you know, Khorne, for example, is, you know, the god of blood, force, anger, bravery, retribution, the fury and war. So the, you know, slain warriors, those are all the types of personalities that kind of fuse together to create and fuel him. And what ends up happening is that the more of those kinds of souls that are added to the warp increase their power. The more followers that they have in the mortal world increase those kind of spirits within the warp and the realm of chaos. So that's how those gods gain power. They get their more followers, more of those personalities enter their pool, and they just keep getting beefed up. You know, Tzeentch, who we talked about last time, you know, he thrives on change, evolution, subtlety, mutation, magic, schemes and plots. Slaanesh is hedonism, masochism, sadism, beauty, addiction, sex, wealth, psychological corruption. So these are all kind of the core mental faults of humanity, and they're common in everybody, and that's really why these four chaos gods each tap into a different element that that mankind as a whole has either a fear or a weakness to. But the one that we really want to talk about this week is Nurgle, and he thrives on decay, deformity, neuroses, necrosis, pity, disease, and physical corruption. So thus, with that, I think we're going to get into the big Grandfather Nurgle.
That's pretty pretty metaphysical for a podcast like this.
It's pretty deep. I mean, chaos is pretty you know, if you actually get into the fun stuff about what chaos is and why it exists in the lore of Warhammer, It's pretty deep stuff. It's pretty fun to think about.
It's pretty symbolic to a lot of religious texts and ideas. It's cool.
Oh God, yeah. What was it? He Nurgle is actually based on a Babylonian god, Nurgal. It's spelled slightly differently, but it sounds very similar. I don't know a lot about him, but I think it was a Babylonian god.
Sounds about right.
We'll say that's true. Confirmed.
So, from my perspective, it's very easy to latch on to something like Khorne. I mean, all right, blood for the blood god. This is about fighting. This is about heavy metal. This is about, you know, ripping and tearing and martial prowess. All right, Slaanesh, pretty easy to get as well. You know, that's the hedonism. That's the temptation. Very easy to associate demons with temptation, stuff like that. Even Tzeentch from that side, you know, it's about magic, it's about change, it's about the long con and the you know, the wheels within wheels and the plots and the machinations. Nurgle, in my mind, is probably one of the toughest for me to get my head wrapped around, that there is so much power and focus on something that is so it isn't something that you go desire.
I think it's funny because people, and I came through this full circle as well, and I know a lot of people do, is everybody kind of starts on some of the more easy ones, and then Nurgle's like, well, dude, who wants to play this big pus-ridden green slime ball? You know, that just doesn't make any sense. What's attractive in that? But then as you play and get more exposed to Warhammer, his long con game, kind of like the he will get you in the end, because he is ultimately the coolest.
Oh, easily the coolest.
All right. Well,
we're not biased at all.
Explain it to me why I would care about disease when there's guys with big axes and sexy demons on the other side.
The best way it was ever described to me in the books was that in a sense Nurgle's the god of everybody, or he has at least a level of control over everybody, because everything in the whole galaxy at some point or another is subject to decay and rot and the general just falling apart of the world. That's what he feeds on. So everybody is still under his thumb on some level. So he has this, he has his short game of playing with poisons and diseases and things like that. But he also, everybody's going to come back to him at some point.
He's the god of entropy, then.
Absolutely. And if anybody's ever read Isaac Asimov's Last Question, best short story ever on entropy.
Yeah, and he needs things to be living in order for him to decay them.
Absolutely. He cherishes all life, and he's actually a very, unlike all the other gods, he's actually a very happy and jovial god, and he loves to give his gifts out to the world, and he equally cherishes all types of life, whether it be a human or a maggot, those are equally as important to him. He doesn't think the maggot is any less a life form as a human, and so when he, distributes his diseases and everything like that, those are living life forms as well that he just cherishes and relishes as gifts for the world.
And that's actually interesting, because you'd think, the temptation would be there in terms of staving off decay. It would be, the immortality, the I want to live forever and all that kind of stuff. But Nurgle isn't about that. Nurgle's about you will wind up in a grave. You will wind up, dead and gone at some point. But at least you're going to have a good time while you're alive.
Well, that brings an interesting point on why somebody would ever even want to follow Nurgle to begin with. I mean, why would you want to take on these diseases? Everybody else offers power and magic and all these great sexy things, but Nurgle, he gives you a disease and a rotting stomach. What's the power in that? And generally you feel that Nurgle is one of a couple ways. Maybe let's say somebody becomes poisoned or becomes corrupted or catches a disease, they may go to Nurgle in order to stave off this disease and take away the pain. He tends to be a little more of a defensively natured, I think he's the polar opposite of, was it Tzeentch?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's the change versus decay.
Yes. But Lester, I know you love this guy too. What's your take on him?
Yeah, that's my take, is that Tzeentch is all about like swift change and things happening quickly, I guess. And Nurgle's all about slow control and decay. And despair, that's what he preys on, the mental characteristic of despair. And that's what he feeds on and how he gets powerful. And he is actually, they say, the most powerful of the gods, but his power ebbs and flows. So as his diseases become more prevalent in the world, he becomes uber powerful and his effects start to bleed into the other worlds. And him and Tzeentch, like their realms border each other. So they kind of clash as Nurgle's garden grows into Tzeentch's realm. Wars happen between them pretty much constantly.
Yeah, speaking of Nurgle's garden and the realms of chaos, they are, from a role-playing perspective, they can be a place that could be visited, though it's something that would most likely just tear your mind and body asunder just upon looking at it. But, Nurgle's garden, I guess, as you could call it, which is a big swampy morass of crazy branches and foliage and decaying matter. As his garden and his power increases, it turns into a big blooming garden that and expands into the neighboring territories. And then and then that's when everybody starts fighting and all the chaos gods start bickering. And then then once his power wanes a bit, that's where his entire garden begins to decay and kind of fuel that just horribleness of his place. And within all that, he's got this big temple with a giant cauldron that he sits over concocting poisons, and he's got Isha, who I think is the goddess of healing. I'm not quite sure if I have that right, but he's got her caged up in his palace, and he judges how potent or successful his poisons are and diseases are by inflicting them on her and determining how long it takes for her to heal herself. And if he decides that it's sufficiently horrible, he will unleash it on the world. Meanwhile, whenever he's distracted, Isha is trying to help mankind to keep themselves in check and teach them how to heal themselves.
What a wonderfully waddling bloke, eh?
I love him.
It's like, oh, me too.
So one of the other the Nurgle's rot. That's a big thing within the whole Nurgle empire. You know, Lester, tell us a little bit about Nurgle's rot.
Well, as far as I understand,
not something you want to catch.
Yeah, as far as I understand, it's the most potent disease that exists in the world of Warhammer. It's like you were saying earlier, Jesse. The Nurgle stands over his giant cauldron, which basically is big enough to have all of the oceans in the world inside it. And he sits there and he brews these concoctions, and he often tastes them to see what happens. But then, like you said, he gives them to Isha to see if they're all right. And the greatest thing he ever invented, I guess, or created was this Nurgle's rot, which most people call just the rot. That's what it's known to the people of the Empire as. And it's kind of a strange disease because it not only affects your body in physical ways, much like leprosy, your skin falls off, your guts rot, you get pustules all over your body, cracking skin and stuff like that. But actually it affects your soul and your mind more than it would affect your body. It's kind of like a demonic possession and a physical malady mixed together. It's the most contagious disease known to man, actually known to any entity in Warhammer. And it begins by affecting your mind, driving people slightly insane, and then it starts to rack their body with all these sores, and it's very unpleasant, essentially. One other cool thing I know about it is the weak of will, they tend to succumb to it quite early. And the end effect is essentially you become siphoned, your soul becomes siphoned out of your body into Nurgle's realm, and then you grow as a pod on one of these plants in his garden, and you eventually become hatched into a Nurgling, basically a gibbering slave to Nurgle, doing his bidding whenever he desires it. But there are some people who are strong enough of will who get Nurgle's rot, and they will move forward, or they'll take up death quests because they don't want their soul to be siphoned into the world. So they will go and do similar to troll slayers. They'll go find the most ridiculous things to fight in order to die before the rot fully takes them. And that's what I understand.
That's a nice transition that you mentioned the Nurglings into the different demons that Nurgle offers up. Kind of like we talked about with Tzeentch last time, there are different classes, you could call them, of demons within the Warhammer world, and Nurgle's no different from that. His smallest, most menial creatures are called Nurglings, and they are little shin-high, gibbering, miniature versions of Nurgle himself. And we haven't really got into what Nurgle looks like. We'll tap into that in just a minute. But they're, suffice to say, they're short, stubby little legs, fat-horned, decrepit little monsters that are kind of bounce around. They're reasonably fast and agile, and they generally have a cloud of flies following them, and they attack in mass.
It's a gremlin.
It's a lot like a gremlin, yeah.
Yeah.
The next step up from that, which is kind of your humanoid-sized and looking creature, is called a plague bearer. And those are typically one big bulging eye, horned, decayed mass of a human with big bloated bellies, and they carry large, crooked swords with all sorts of poisons and diseases laced on them. And they again will almost always be accompanied by a cloud of flies and attacks that would typically be things like vomiting and clawing you and just trying to get near to you to inflict whatever diseases they can upon you. Once you kind of go beyond that, it gets a little stranger into the larger creatures, the things like Beasts of Nurgle, which may be a little a little difficult to kind of pin a description on, but you know, you could picture anything from a slug to a giant decayed bison looking thing to a big tentacled monster. They kind of have a lot more similarities to a Chaos Spawn and some kind of mount than they would to any specific looking creature. But the one that we really want to talk about.
But the Beasts of Nurgle, the thing that I like about the Beasts of Nurgle is that their temperament is a happy puppy. So they're not actually malicious in nature. They just want to play. So they keep on scampering around the encounter or battlefield and stuff like that. And then they lick you, which is a paralyzing slime that they excrete, because they want to play, and then they paralyze it, and then other guy, you know, everything all swarms around them and gives them a bunch of disease, and then they bound off to go. So you've got this huge slug, multi-tentacled, evil,
that just wants to play with
nasty
you.
Looking thing that's just hopping around the battlefield, very, all happy and excited and quivering.
Yeah, it's very important to remember that Nurgle and his demons and his cultist followers are all generally very happy people. They are very jovial, and they love to bestow their gifts. You know, these are very important words, gifts. You know, it's not like, something they're cursing somebody with. They want to give it to you because they think that you'll want it too.
And he's like a giant rotting Santa Claus.
Like a giant rotting Santa. You got it, man. You got
it. Isn't that one of the affectations, is Grandfather Nurgle?
Yes.
For that?
Yeah, they call him,
generally,
yeah,
he'll,
yeah,
call everybody his children, and they look up to him as their father or their grandfather or Papa Nurgle, things like that. So he's, to give him a little more color to actually Nurgle himself, is we'll start talking about the Great Unclean One, which is the greater demon of Nurgle. And unlike a lot of the other Chaos Gods, the Great Unclean One is actually a facsimile of Nurgle himself. I mean, it is a carbon copy of him, you know, in physical form. Looks just like him, acts just like him, may not be quite as large, but in essence, it is Nurgle himself when you see a Great Unclean One. They are huge, horned, fat, distended tummies, short legs, huge, giant, what do you call his sword? It's the... he's got some big old honking Sword of Decay that I don't remember its name.
Plague Giver.
The Plague Sword. And, you know, it's dipped in every manner of poison that he's ever concocted. So, Great Unclean Ones are absolutely hideous and super cool. I don't know if anybody's ever played the Warhammer Online MMO game, but at some point when you fight one of those, he'll act near the end of the battle, he'll grab you and swallow your party whole, and you'll have to fight your way out from the inside of his stomach, and then get back out onto the battlefield to finish him off.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I guess so. So that pretty much covers the Nurgle demons. They're a lot of fun. But, you know, we also want to talk about how do you use all these guys in gameplay sessions, and how do you fold Nurgle into your plots. Arguably, I think this is actually one of the easiest ones to fold into your games, because there's so much damn... poison and disease in the Warhammer world that you could very easily contribute a cult of Nurgle to participating in that.
Yeah, the plague-stricken village is kind of your classic right there. And whether it was, you know, the plague struck and then everybody turned to Nurgle, or everybody turned to Nurgle and then the plague struck, a little bit of a chicken and an egg kind of idea right
well,
there.
Well, that's a really fun part you just touched on there, which I started to touch on earlier, but I want to expand on it for a second, is that Nurgle, you don't always have to include as the instigator of a plague, because people will often turn to Nurgle after they've been infected. And that maybe is when the cult gets formed. So
now,
you can actually kind of go either way.
Could you also tie the Skaven into Nurgle? The Skaven are my favorite army in the Warhammer Fantasy's battles, and they worship the Great Horned One, and they're about plague.
Yeah, the whole clan Pestilens sect of the Skaven culture is a bit of Skaven, who also happen to have a lot of influence from Nurgle. So they, I don't know a ton about that yet, but we do plan on doing a session. Or a spotlight on Skaven as a whole. So we'll definitely hit that up in the near future.
By and large, though, the Skaven are kind of an independent entity. I mean, they've got their own culture. They've got their own Like you said, the great horned one, the god that they worship and things like that. So although they may be cousins, they're not necessarily on friendly terms, because they're kind of that whole decay and corruption from within is kind of a Skaven theme as well. So they just fight on a metaphysical turf as well as actual physical turf more often than
But where Lester may have been going there was that, you know, the humans aren't the only ones affected and at war with chaos. I mean, chaos affects everything in the Warhammer world, Skaven included. So a lot of their culture, you know, like the Clan Pestilence specifically, is influenced. You know, maybe they don't worship it, maybe they do, but either way, they are certainly maybe affected by the powers of chaos around them.
Or maybe they worship it in a different way, just giving it a different name. But yeah, it is in fact
Warpstone
the same thing.
Yeah, they Warpstone is the power of chaos infused in a rock, you know, and it kind of takes off from there.
Yeah, because Skaven are creatures of chaos.
Oh yeah.
But anyway,
we'll save that for another time. Yeah, that's a fun, and Skaven are a very interesting topic on their own. But lastly, you know, the Nurgle was introduced into Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition in the Signs of Faith box set. Which gave us all manner of creatures and cards and even some special characters. Also gave us all the Nurgle spells, which are a blast. I don't think we're really going to go too in detail on what they are, because the general style and feel of what those spells are is pretty easy to guess. I mean, it's all manner of bestowing pox and disease and decay on anybody, and you know, the clouds of flies to hinder them from attacking you. It's really just a blast to do, and
I think one of our future system spotlights is going to be around damage, because Warhammer isn't just about, I think we've talked about this before, Warhammer isn't just about losing hit points. It's about losing your sanity, it's about losing control over your body, it's about disease and mutation and insanity and all of those sorts of things as well. So I think we're going to spend a whole system spotlight segment on all the ways that you as a player can get completely hosed in the Warhammer world, and disease is definitely going to be a big part of that.
Oh, yeah.
All the fun narrator tools, right?
That's right.
Exactly.
Absolutely. But I think that pretty much covers it up on Grandfather Nurgle.
Great. Excellent. So we're going to take another quick break, and then we'll come back with your questions.
All hail the Plague Father.
And we're back. And as always, you can submit your questions in written and audio format to recklessdice@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @recklessdice, like Homer Clone did. He asks, "Thanks for the great podcast. I'm new to Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay and would like advice on tapping into the online community, blogs, etc. What would you guys suggest?"
So there's actually a new blog that just started up by one of the Fantasy Flight Forum goers, Doc Cthulhu. So he's got a blog called Daily Empire, and we'll put that into the show notes. And he's doing some pretty good stuff on putting up some links and news and stuff like that about Warhammer 3rd Edition in general.
He's been actually pretty active over the last couple of weeks, adding content to that very regularly.
Yep.
Yeah, he definitely hit the ground running with that one.
And, of course, the forums, the Fantasy Flight forums, you're not going to get any kind of developer interaction there, but there is definitely a core of people in there that are very good at answering questions and discussing certain things.
I'd probably stick to the general topic forum section. The GM and the other sub-forums of that don't seem to have as active a community as the general forum.
Probably the other two forums that I'd look into is RPG Geek. They've got a bajillion forums out there, one for every game. There is a Warhammer 3rd Edition forum. Not very active out there. But then probably the last place that I'd recommend you go to is try out a Strike to Stun. Now, this is the bastion of the 2nd Edition folks, and the 3rd Edition forum that's there isn't very active, but if you're looking for Warhammer in general, that's a really great place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. Simon Sommerfeld emailed into us, in my games, fights mostly turn into one giant melee engagement because I find it logical for the weaker opponents to gang up on the most dangerous PC. So he's asking, how do you stretch fights more and make movement and more of a tactical component of combats? So do you guys have that same problem where everybody gets in a fight and it just turns into one big honking mess?
Not overly. I find that my players tend to play relatively tactical in their own right, because the game itself isn't designed like D&D, where it is right down to the 5-foot step tactical, you know, approach to combat. I do find that it does tend to lend itself to a little bit, maybe this is just my players, but a little bit dry. I play melee strike, you know, instead of hamming it up and describing what their characters do. But as far as suggestions go, he wants suggestions for more tactical combat.
I think he wants to know what can he do as a GM to make the combat, if his players aren't doing it on their own, what can he do to encourage them to be a little more, to move around a little more, or maybe, you know, use the environment more?
I think
talking about terrain, even though it's still, you know, with the abstract movement there, you know, there's still different ideas and different locations that you can narrate in there, whether it's based on a location card or not. And I also think is that don't be afraid to throw some variety in your enemies as well. So, you know, it's not just orcs bashing into your guys. It's orcs with some goblin archers in the tree line, or there's a goblin shaman who's powering up a spell. So, you know, if you're not up there at the front line fighting those three orcs that are in front of you, if you don't do something about the goblin shaman that's hiding behind a rock, you know, 30 feet back or, you know, within close range or medium range, then you could be in a world of hurt in a couple of turns. So you got to move, you know, you got to break through, you got to get past them. I think just throwing some variety in there, don't think MMO, don't think, you know, all right, I've got this mob and the mob moves forward and it aggroes on the melee guys and then it tries to kill those guys and it moves on to the next one. You know, put a little intelligence and thought into your creatures as well, and have them think tactically so that then your characters have to react tactically as well.
And I think, Paul, earlier on, you had, maybe it was before the show, you had mentioned that adding a variety of terrain to force people to react to or maneuver around, or, you know, leverage those location cards that only allow a certain number of people into combat at a time, like the narrow bridges or the narrow hallways. Those kind of things will really force your players to actually think, who am I actually going to put on the front line here? Who's not going to fight? How do we get around this so we can help out on the other side? So kind of try and use all those things in conjunction and force your players to make decisions that are not just engage the guys in front of us.
They're both great advice there.
Sebastian Sturz emails in, I'm interested in your house rules while using map tools. So, again, for those of you who don't know, map tools is the free program we use available at rptools.net to play with a digital game board over the PC. Generally, there's only a handful of house rules that we really use. One of them is the conversion of the abstract movement. We've done away with that and replaced that with more of a typical, 30-foot movement per maneuver system, because it lends itself better to actually playing on a map. Maybe even to relate it to our the previous question, I have had very little problem with things turning into a giant melee with map tools, because there is a very clearly defined terrain for people to utilize, and they end up very strategically using it the entire time. The other house rules we use, oh gosh, there's a couple, but that the movement is probably the biggest one. Paul, help me out here. I'm drawing a blank.
See, well, maybe when I take over as GM, I'd really like to try to wedge a party card.
Yeah, currently we haven't been using that. Right. You're right.
Yeah. But I still think there's some cool stuff we can do. You can do with party cards as well. I think those are the two big ones: is movement and party cards, right?
Because everything else we can either monitor through tokens on your player cards in game, or through the game system, or just at each person's computer. They're still encouraged to have their own character sheets and maintain their own action cards and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a lot easier. Map Tools is a way to kind of share in the experience and the dice roller and things like that. But in terms of managing your own character, you definitely either want an expanded character sheet, a light character sheet, or your own character sheet and components in front of you to keep things moving and keep things tracking.
From a personal perspective, as a GM, style that I prefer, which I'm sure some people hate me for, is I like to keep the game moving as quickly as possible and always having something happen. And so anything that really gets in my way of having to do some bookkeeping or stall the game so we can set up a chart or something like that, I'm usually not in favor of. So from my own personal perspective or preference, I tend not to use the tracking meters too often. Sometimes I'll use them just on my end, but more often than not, those will not be used. Location cards, things like that. I have those all as a part of the map tool setup, so that we're able to, everybody has a visual representation of what those look like and their effects. So all in all, we don't sacrifice a whole lot for house rules. The movement is the one major component, though.
And just from a style standpoint, I'm very much. I guess I'm a pretty orthodox GM. I really want to play rules as written, because I'm not an RPG designer, and I'm giving the designers the benefit of the doubt that they've thought about this stuff and put it all in there. So it's really got to be something. It's got to be something mechanical or something that we've tried and failed on before I'm willing to start breaking out house rules. Because I think sometimes, and maybe that's just the people that we interact with on the internet are obviously very into role playing. That's why they get out there and participate in these groups. But it just seems that you go out to RPG.net, you go out to the forums out there, and it seems like every single thread has half the people in there are saying, well, when I play it, I don't do it this way, but I do it this mm-hmm. way, and there's definitely a thing for that, and that's the armchair game designer and stuff like that, but that's definitely not my style.
Well, I think that the flexibility of the system allows it to where it can be exactly what, Paul, you need it to be, or it can be what I need it to be. I mean, when I GM, I probably just forget rules more than I consciously choose not to use them. And I just more concentrate on keeping the flow and the story moving. And then I play it more and more and more, I realize, oh God, I totally forgot that rule. I'll try and fold that in next time and just kind of keep building on that library. The game fully functions if you only use 50% of its rules, but it really shines if you're able to incorporate all of them. But if you have to stall your game so poorly that you can't actually run a game well because you're so focused on trying to use every single rule, I'm not sure. It's a balancing act of making sure that you can kind of figure out which ones are appropriate based on compared to the pacing of the game.
Especially with the map tools too, you don't want to be stopping so that you can go and reference rules and stuff like that. With the recording of the map tools, that'd just be a great waste of time. I think the way you guys run it so far is great.
Oh, I don't do any editing to our map tools game sessions. They run completely mm-hmm. flawless the whole time from start to finish.
Oh, they're perfect.
We don't have any rules questions or crazy breaks or crazy sounds that happen in there. What are you talking about? Yeah, that's a long session to edit afterwards to try and clean those up for you guys. But we do appreciate all your guys' feedback and questions, and we do read all questions and comments that come in. So please keep them coming, and we will discuss them in future episodes.
Yeah, we're not able. We've actually got a decent amount of questions, and we appreciate them all coming in, but we can't get to them each episode because we want to keep these podcasts down to a reasonable length. So hopefully we'll be able to get to everybody's questions in future episodes. But in the interest of time, I think we're going to wrap it up for this episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. Please feel free to leave comments on the site. We're at recklessdice.rorschach.net. Send us an email, as Jesse said, at recklessdice@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, @recklessdice. And please, please, we would love it. We know there's a lot of iTunes users out there. Give us a star rating or send us some feedback on there. We'd love to see ourselves maybe get a little bumped up in the rankings on iTunes out there. And we'd love it if you guys can help us out. So thanks for listening.
Give us bad feedback if that's appropriate, too. Just any review. Yeah, that's fine. We constructive feedback's a good thing. You guys said you didn't want me talking in your left ear and the players in the right ear, and we listened. Sorry about that, by the way.
All right, so we'll see you guys in 2 weeks. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Have a good night.
Night, everyone.
Have a good night.